podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Lensic and tonight's evening with Don DeLillo. I'm Mark Danner. I'm a writer and journalist, write mostly about war, terrorism, violence, and other delightful subjects. And I want to welcome you here in that spirit and thank the Lannan Foundation for the invitation to be here. I am honored to take part tonight, not least because over 25 years of writing about war and politics and violence, no writer has meant more to me than Don DeLillo. He has taught me how to see, or at least how to focus on the act of seeing. It is a problem that reporters and journalists deal with every day and every hour that they are out in the field at work. You fly into Baghdad, you're bombarded with sensory impressions, you're bombarded with opinions, you're bombarded with shocking images. And what is it you pick out from that maelstrom of impressions as important, as necessary, as real, as the thing that you have to convey to your audience? In a sense, that question is Don DeLillo's subject. How indeed to see? It's interesting, or was interesting to me, in looking through critical opinions about Don's most recent novel, Point Omega, from which he will read tonight. There was a focus in the views of the critics on the prophetic power of DeLillo's work, on his power of prophecy. This phrase and this word comes up again and again, the power to predict the future. I was surprised by that, because it seems to me that predicting the future is not all that difficult. The difficult thing is what Don does and what distinguishes him, it seems to me, from every other contemporary writer. He is able to anatomize the present, to see what's different about it, to see what's shocking about it, and most of all, to look below the surface, below those things that we come after day, month after month, year after year, to take for granted as the commonplaces of our world, and restore to them their sense of strangeness, their sense of radical, revolutionary strangeness. I want to read a passage or two from his work, and then say a word about his career, and then bring him out here. The first passage is from his 1991 novel, Mao Two. It's at the end of the prologue. It describes, that prologue, as many of you probably know, describes in astonishing detail, in shocking detail, an event at Yankee Stadium, the marriage of thousands, mass marriage of thousands of young people under the eyes of the great leader, Chairman Moon, or Reverend Moon, I should say. Slip of the tongue. The thousands stand and chant. Around them in the world, people ride escalators going up and sneak secret glances at the faces coming down. People dangle tea bags over hot water in white cups. Cars run silently on the Autobahn, streaks of painted light. People sit at desks and stare at office walls. They smell their shirts and drop them in the hamper. People bind themselves into numbered seats and fly across time zones and high cirrus and deep night, knowing there is something they've forgotten to do. The future belongs to crowds. First passage. The second is from his more recent novel, Falling Man, and describes a scene that I'm quite attached to because I've seen it myself. I live in the neighborhood. It's from the Upper West Side of Manhattan. Keith walked through the park and came out on West 90th Street, and it was strange what he was seeing down by the community garden and coming toward him, a woman in the middle of the street on horseback, wearing a yellow hard hat and carrying a riding crop, bobbing above the traffic. And it took him a long moment to understand that horse and rider had come out of a stable somewhere nearby and were headed toward the bridle path in the park. It was something that belonged to another landscape, something inserted, a conjuring that resembled, for the briefest second, some half-seen image only half-believed in the seeing, when the witness wonders what has happened to the meaning of things, to tree, street, stone, wind, simple words lost in the falling ash. This novel is, in part, takes up the disassociation of sensibility, if one can call it that, after the 9/11 attacks. And then finally, a passage I particularly prize, and which Don is probably tired of hearing recited at events. But these are the words of the writer Bill Gray, the famously reclusive writer who is at the heart of Mao II. He says, "I'm a sentence maker, like a donut maker, only slower." And then every sentence has a truth waiting at the end of it, and the writer learns how to know it when he finally gets there. On one level, this truth is the swing of the sentence, the beat and poise. But down deeper, it's the integrity of the writer as he matches with the language. I've always seen myself in sentences. I begin to recognize myself word by word as I work through a sentence. The language of my books has shaped me as a man. There's a moral force in a sentence when it comes out right. It speaks the writer's will to live. Let me say a word about Don's life. He was born on November 30th, 1936, in New York City, apart from a little time spent in Pennsylvania as a child, and in Greece, where he lived with his wife Barbara Bennett in the early 80s. Barbara, by the way, is here with us tonight as well. He has spent all of his life in and around New York City. He attended Fordham College, majoring, at least according to him, in something called communication arts. It's a strangely DeLillo phrase. After graduating, he worked for a time, I'm not supposed to say this, but in the advertising industry for several years. Eventually left. There was a time also during this period when, I think this was during college, when he worked presiding over a parking lot, if I'm not mistaken, which gave him an enormous amount of time to read voraciously. He published short stories beginning in the early 60s, and then in 1971 appeared his first novel, Americana. And then in the time since, we have 14 additional novels. Reading them off, there are many favorites here. And indeed, one of the pleasures of doing an event like this, and I thank Lannan most profoundly for this, is you get a chance to reread the work of an author you love. End Zone, Great Jones Street, Ratner Star, Players, Running Dog, The Names, which is the first DeLillo novel I read. It was published in 1982. Extraordinary work. Set in Greece and in the Middle East, and taking up, as many of his books do, terrorism. Then White Noise, which won the National Book Award, among other things. Libra, which centered around the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Mao II, from which I just read. Underworld, The Body Artist, Cosmopolis, Falling Man in 2007, and Point Omega. Now, these works have won every literary award one can name, in addition to the National Book Award, the William Dean Howells Medal, the Penn Faulkner Award, the Jerusalem Prize, which is awarded for a body of work. I have a page here that lists single-spaced a great number of awards, and I won't go through them. Let me say a little word about Point Omega, Don DeLillo's new novel. I woke up this morning with a great sense of relish because I had been preventing myself from the last few weeks from doing what I wanted to do, which was to sit down and read this novel again. I started at 8 this morning and read it with enormous fascination and pleasure. It is, well, I can say that there is nothing like it in his work. It is an amazing combination of novel of ideas and very provocative ideas about where we are now, war, power, the Iraq War, extraordinary rendition, time, loss. It is also a novel of suspense and an amazing mystery that Henry James, among others, would have loved, that yields up its secrets, or a completely different set of secrets, on a second reading. It is preceded and ended with a wonderful prologue and epilogue that center around Psycho, Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, a movie that plays a key role throughout the book in a way I think we will discuss in the dialogue after Don reads. He will be signing these books afterwards, and I must say that I'm still kind of vibrating with the experience of rereading this book and the secrets that it yielded up on the second reading that I had not understood in the first. Well, I could go on. I will not. What I will ask you to do is join me and the Lannan Foundation in welcoming to Santa Fe Don DeLillo.
Thank you, Mel.
A pleasure.
Point Omega is a novel in three parts. And recently, I don't know exactly why, I've begun thinking about it in visual terms as a triptych with a prologue and an epilogue in black and white and a central narrative in color. The novel begins in a gallery space at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City. And there is an anonymous man watching a video work called 24-Hour Psycho. From the prologue, September 3rd. There was a man standing against the north wall, barely visible. People entered in twos and threes, and they stood in the dark and looked at the screen, and then they left. Sometimes they hardly moved past the doorway, larger groups wandering in, tourists in a daze, and they looked and shifted their weight, and then they left. There were no seats in the gallery. The screen was freestanding, about 10 by 14 feet, not elevated, placed in the middle of the room. It was a translucent screen, and some people, a few, remained long enough to drift to the other side. They stayed a moment longer, and then they left. The gallery was cold and lighted only by the faint gray shimmer on the screen. Back by the north wall, the darkness was nearly complete, and the man standing alone moved a hand toward his face, repeating, ever so slowly, the action of a figure on the screen. The film ran without dialogue or music, no soundtrack at all. The museum guard stood just inside the door, and people leaving sometimes looked at him, seeking eye contact, some kind of understanding that might pass between them and make their bafflement valid. There were other galleries, entire floors. No point lingering in the secluded room in which whatever was happening took forever to happen. The man at the wall watched the screen and then began to move along the adjacent wall to the other side of the screen so he could watch the same action in a flipped image. He watched Anthony Perkins reaching for a car door, using the right hand. He knew that Anthony Perkins would use the right hand on this side of the screen and the left hand on the other side. He knew it, but needed to see it. And he moved through the darkness along the side wall and then edged away a few feet to watch Anthony Perkins on this side of the screen the reverse side. Anthony Perkins using the left hand, the wrong hand, to reach for a car door and then open it. But could he call the left hand the wrong hand? Because what made this side of the screen any less truthful than the other side? He found himself undistracted for some minutes by the coming and going of others, and he was able to look at the film with the degree of intensity that was required. The nature of the film permitted total concentration and also dependent on it. The film's merciless pacing had no meaning without a corresponding watchfulness. The single individual whose absolute alertness did not betray what was demanded. He stood and looked. In the time it took for Anthony Perkins to turn his head, there seemed to flow an array of ideas involving science and philosophy and nameless other things. Or maybe he was seeing too much. But it was impossible to see too much. The less there was to see, the harder he looked, the more he saw. This was the point. To see what's here, finally. To look and to know you're looking. To feel time passing. To be alive to what's happening in the smallest registers of motion. He'd been standing for more than 3 hours looking. This was the fifth straight day he'd come here. And it was the next to last day before the installation shut down and went to another city or was placed in obscure storage somewhere. No one entering seemed to know what to expect. And surely no one expected this. The original movie had been slowed to a running time of 24 hours. What he was watching seemed pure film, pure time. The broad horror of the old Gothic movie was subsumed in time. How long would he have to stand here? How many weeks or months before the film's time scheme absorbed his own, or had this already begun to happen? He understood completely why the film was projected without sound. It had to be silent. It had to engage the individual at a depth beyond the usual assumptions, the things he supposes and presumes and takes for granted. Everybody remembers the killer's name, Norman Bates, but nobody remembers the victim's name. Anthony Perkins is Norman Bates. Janet Lee is Janet Lee. The victim is required to share the name of the actress who plays her. It is Janet Lee who enters the remote motel owned by Norman Bates. The film made him feel like someone watching a film. The meaning of this escaped him. He kept feeling things whose meaning escaped him. He counted six rings, the rings spinning on the curtain rod, when Janet Lee pulls the curtain down with her. The knife, the silence, the spinning rings. It takes close attention to see what is happening in front of you. It takes work, pious effort, to see what you are looking at. He was mesmerized by this. The depths that were possible in the slowing of motion, the things to see, the depths of things so easy to miss in the shallow habit of seeing. He watched the actor's eyes in slow transit across his bony socket. Did he imagine himself seeing with the actor's eyes? Or did the actor's eyes seem to be searching him out? It felt real. The pace was paradoxically real. Bodies moving musically, barely moving, 12-tone, things barely happening, cause and effect so drastically drawn apart that it seemed real to him, the way all the things in the physical world that we don't understand are said to be real. The door slid open, and there was a stir of mild traffic at the far end of the floor. People getting on the escalator, a clerk swiping credit cards, a clerk tossing items into large, sleek museum bags. Light and sound, wordless monotone, an intimation of life beyond, world beyond, the strange, bright fact that lives and eats out there, the thing that's not the movies. From the central narrative, the true life is not reducible to words spoken or written, not by anyone, ever. The true life takes place when we're alone, thinking, feeling, lost in memory, dreamingly self-aware, the sub-microscopic moments. He said this more than once, Elster did, in more than one way. His life happened, he said, when he sat staring at a blank wall, thinking about dinner. An 800-page biography is nothing more than dead conjecture, he said. I almost believed him when he said such things. He said, we do this all the time, all of us. We become ourselves beneath the running thoughts and dim images, wondering idly when we'll die. This is how we live and think, whether we know it or not. These are the unsorted thoughts we have, looking out the train window, small, dull smears of meditative panic. The sun was burning down. This is what he wanted, to feel the deep heat beating into his body, feel the body itself, reclaim the body from what he called the nausea of news and traffic. This was desert, out beyond cities and scattered towns. He was here to eat, sleep, and sweat, here to do nothing, sit and think. There was the house and then nothing but distances, not vistas or sweeping sight lines, but only distances. He was here, he said, to stop talking. There's no one to talk to but me. He did this sparingly at first and never at sunset. These were not glorious retirement sunsets of stocks and bonds. To Elster, sunset was human invention, our perceptual arrangement of light and space into elements of wonder. We looked and wondered. There was a trembling in the air as the unnamed colors and landforms took on definition, a clarity of outline and extent. Maybe it was the age difference between us that made me think he felt something else at last light, a persistent disquiet, uninvented. This would explain the silence. News and traffic, sports and weather. These were his acid terms for the life he'd left behind. More than 2 years of living with the tight minds that made the war. It was all background noise, he said, waving a hand. He liked to wave a hand in dismissal. There were the risk assessments and policy papers, the interagency working groups. He was the outsider, a scholar with an approval rating with no experience in government. He sat at a table in a secure conference room with the strategic planners and military analysts. He was there to conceptualize, his word in quotes, to apply overarching ideas and principles to such matters as troop deployment and counterinsurgency. He was cleared to read classified cables and restricted transcripts, he said, and he listened to the chatter of the resident experts, the metaphysicians in the intelligence agencies, the fantasists in the Pentagon. The third floor of the E-ring at the Pentagon, bulk and swagger, he said. He'd exchanged all that for space and time. These were things he seemed to absorb through his pores. There were the distances that enfolded every feature of the landscape, and there was the force of geologic time out there somewhere, the string grids of excavators searching for weathered bone. I keep seeing the words, heat, space, stillness, distance. They've become visual states of mind. I'm not sure what that means. I keep seeing figures in isolation. I see past physical dimension into the feeling that these words engender, feelings that deepen over time. That's the other word, time. I drove and looked. He stayed at the house, sitting on the creaky deck in a band of shade, reading. I hiked into palm washes and up unmarked trails, always water, carrying water everywhere, always a hat, wearing a broad-brimmed hat and a neckerchief. And I stood on promontories in punishing sun, stood and looked. The desert was outside my range. It was an alien being. It was science fiction, both saturating and remote, and I had to force myself to believe I was here. He knew where he was, in his chair. Alive to the proto-world, I thought, the seas and reefs of 10 million years ago. He closed his eyes, silently divining the nature of later extinctions, grassy plains in picture books for children, a region swarming with happy camels and giant zebras, mastodons, saber-toothed tigers. Extinction was a current theme of his. The landscape inspired themes, spaciousness and claustrophobia. This would become a theme. Richard Elster was 73. I was less than half his age. He'd invited me to join him here, old house, underfurnished, somewhere south of nowhere in the Sonoran Desert, or maybe it was the Mojave Desert, or another desert altogether. Not a long visit, he said. This was day 10. I'd talked to him twice before in New York, and he knew what I had in mind, his participation in a film I wanted to make about his time in government, in the blat and stammer of Iraq. He would, in fact, be the only participant. His face, his words. This was all I needed. No plush armchair with warm lighting and books on a shelf in the background. Just a man and a wall, I told him. The man stands there and relates the complete experience, everything that comes to mind, personalities, theories, details, feelings. You're the man. There's no off-screen voice asking questions. There's no interspersed combat footage or comments from others, on camera or off. What else? A simple headshot. What else, he said. Any pauses, they're your pauses. I keep shooting. What else? Digitally shot. One continuous take. How long a take? Depends on you. There's a Russian film, feature film, Russian Ark, Alexander Sokurov, a single extended shot, about 1,000 actors and extras, 3 orchestras, history, fantasy, crowd scenes, ballroom scenes. And then an hour into the movie, a waiter drops a napkin. No cut, can't cut. Camera flying down hallways and around corners. 99 minutes, I said. But that was a man named Alexander Sokurov. Your name is Jim Finley. I would have laughed if he hadn't delivered the line with a smirk. Elster spoke Russian, and he pronounced the director's name with an earthy flourish. This gave his remark an extra measure of self-satisfaction. I could have made the obvious point that I wouldn't be shooting large numbers of people in textured motion. But I let the joke live out its full term. He was not a man who might make space for even the gentlest correction. We sat out late, scotch for both of us, bottle on the deck and stars and clusters. He told me that he had all source clearance or access to every sensitive sliver of military intelligence. I knew this wasn't true. It was in his voice and face, a bitter wishfulness. And I understood, of course, that he was telling me things, true or not, only because I was here. We were both here, in isolation, drinking. I was his confidant by default, the young man entrusted with the details of his makeshift reality. I talked to them one day about war, he said. Iraq is a whisper, I told them. These nuclear flirtations we've been having with this or that government, little whispers, he said. I'm telling you, this will change. Something's coming. But isn't this what we want? Isn't this the burden of consciousness? We're all played out. Matter wants to lose its self-consciousness. We're the mind and heart that matter has become. Time to close it all down. This is what drives us now. He refilled his glass and passed me the bottle. I was enjoying this. We want to be the dead matter we used to be. We're the last billionth of a second in the evolution of matter. When I was a student, I looked for radical ideas, scientists, theologians. I read the work of mystics through the centuries. I was a hungry mind, a pure mind. I fill notebooks with my versions of world philosophy. Look at us today. We keep inventing folk tales of the end. Animal diseases spreading, transmittable cancers. What else? The climate, I said. The climate. The asteroid, I said. The asteroid, the meteorite, what else? Famine, worldwide. Famine, he said, what else? Give me a minute. Never mind, because this isn't interesting to me. I have no use for this. We need to think beyond this. I didn't want him to stop. We sat drinking quietly, and I tried to think of further workable prospects for the end of human life on Earth. I was a student. I ate lunch and studied. I studied the work of Teilhard de Chardin, he said. He went to China, an outlaw priest, China, Mongolia, digging for bones. I ate lunch on open books. I didn't need a tray. He said that human thought is alive, it circulates in the sphere of collective human thought. This is approaching the final term, the last flare. There was a North American camel. Where is it now? I nearly said in Saudi Arabia. Instead, I passed the bottle back to him. You told them things. Were these policy board meetings? Who was there, I said? Cabinet level people? Military people? Whoever was there, that's who was there. I liked this answer. It said everything. The more I thought about it, the clearer everything seemed. He paused and drank and paused again. What are we? I don't know. We're a crowd, a swarm. We think in groups, travel in armies. Armies carry the gene for self-destruction. One bomb is never enough. The blur of technology. This is where the oracles plot their wars. Because now comes the introversion, the omega point, a leap out of our biology. Ask yourself this question. Do we have to be human forever? Consciousness is exhausted. Back now to inorganic matter. This is what we want. We want to be stones in a field. I talked to Elster about an essay he'd written a few years earlier called Renditions. It appeared in a scholarly journal and soon began to stir criticism from the left. This may have been his intention, but all I could find in those pages was an implied challenge to figure out what the point was. The first sentence was, "A government is a criminal enterprise." The last sentence was, "In future years, of course, men and women in cubicles wearing headphones will be listening to secret tapes of the administration's crimes, while others study electronic records on computer screens, and still others look at salvaged videotapes of caged men being subjected to various physical pain. And finally others, still others, behind closed doors, ask pointed questions of flesh and blood individuals." What lay between these sentences was a study of the word rendition, with references to Middle English, Old French, Vulgar Latin, and other sources and origins. Early on, Elster cited one of the meanings of rendering, a coat of plaster applied to a masonry surface. From this, he asked the reader to consider a walled enclosure in an unnamed country and a method of questioning, using what he called enhanced interrogation techniques that was meant to induce a surrender, one of the meanings of rendition, the giving up or giving back in the person being interrogated. I didn't read the piece at the time, knew nothing about it. If I had known, before I knew Elster, what would I have thought? Word origins and covert prisons, old French, obsolete French, and torture by proxy. The essay concentrated on the word itself, earliest known use, changes in form and meaning, zero-grade forms, reduplicated forms, suffixed forms. There were footnotes like nested snakes, but no specific mention of black sites, third-party states, or international treaties and conventions. He compared the evolution of a word to that of organic matter. He pointed out that words were not necessary to one's experience of the true life. Toward the end of the commentary, he wrote about select current meanings of the word rendition, interpretation, translation, performance. Within those walls, somewhere in seclusion, a drama is being enacted, old as human memory, he wrote. Actors naked, chained, blindfolded, other actors with props of intimidation, the renderers, nameless and masked, dressed in black, and what ensues, he wrote, is a revenge play that reflects the mass will and interprets the shadowy need of an entire nation, ours. What had he thought of the charge that he tried to find mystery and romance in a word that was being used as an instrument of state security, a word redesigned to be synthetic, concealing the shameful subject it embraced? But I didn't ask this question. Instead, I went inside and poured two glasses of ice water and came back out and sat in the chair alongside him. I wondered if he was right, that the country needed this. We needed it in our desperation, our dwindling, needed something, anything, whatever we could get. Rendition, yes, and then invasion. This was day 12. He looked at the beer glass in his hand and announced that his daughter would be coming to visit. It was like hearing that the earth had shifted on its axis, spinning night back into budding day. Significant news, someone else, a face and voice, called Jesse, he said, an exceptional mind, otherworldly. A great rain came sweeping off the mountains, too strong to think into, leaving us with nothing to say. We stood in the covered entrance to the deck, we three, watching and listening, world awash. Jessie held herself tightly, each flung hand clutching the opposite shoulder. The air was sharp and charged, and when the rain stopped in minutes, we went back to the living room and talked about what we were talking about when the sky broke open. In those first days, I thought of her as the daughter. Elster's possessiveness, his enclosing space, made it hard for me to set her apart, to find some semblance of an independent being. He wanted her near him all the time. When he said something meant for me, he always included her, drew her in through look or gesture. His eyes showed an eager glow, father regarding child, but it seemed to have the effect of smothering a response, or maybe she wasn't interested in making one. She was pale and thin, mid-twenties, awkward, with a soft face, not fleshy but roundish and calm. And she seemed attentive to some interior presence. Her father said she heard words from inside them. I didn't ask what he meant by this. It was his job to say such things. Most of the time we talked about nothing, she and I. I liked these talks. They were quiet, with eerie depth in every stray remark she made. I stared at her sometimes, waiting for what? A return look, a show of discomfort? There was something self-determined in her look, a blandness that seemed willed. It was a choice she'd made to look like this, or so I told myself. Her bed was never made. I opened the bedroom door and looked several times, but did not enter. The night she talked about art galleries in Chelsea. She used to visit the galleries with a friend named Alicia. She said Alicia was deep as a dime. She said they'd walk down the long street, choosing galleries at random, and looking at the art, and then walking down the street again, and around the corner, and up the next street, walking and looking. And one day, she thought of something inexplicable. Let's do the same thing, up and down the same streets, but without going in the galleries. Alicia said yes, like instantly. They did this, and it was quietly exciting, she said. It was like the idea of both their lifetimes. Walking down those long and mostly empty streets on weekday afternoons and unspokenly bypassing the art and then crossing the street and walking up the other side of the same street and turning the corner and going to the next street and walking down the next street and crossing to the other side and walking up the same street, down and then up and then over to the next street again and again, just walking and talking. It honestly deepened the experience, she said, made it better and more appreciative, street after street. Passing into air, it seemed this is what she was meant to do, what she was made for. 2 full days, no word, no sign. Had she strayed past the edge of conjecture? Or were we willing to imagine what had happened? I tried not to think beyond geography, every moment defined by the desolation around us. But imagination was itself a natural force, unmanageable. Animals, I thought, and what they do to bodies in the wild or in the mind. No safe place. He referred to her now as Jessica, the real name, the birth name. He spoke in fragments, opening and closing his hand. I could watch him being driven insistently inward. The desert was clairvoyant. This is what he'd always believed, that the landscape unraveled and revealed a new future as well as past. But now it made him feel enclosed, and I understood this, hemmed in, pressed tight. We stood outside and felt the desert bearing in. Sterile thunder seemed to hang over the hills. Stormlight washing toward us. 100 childhoods, he said obscurely. Meaning what? The thunder, maybe. A soft, evocative rumble sounding down the years. Every lost moment is the life. It's unknowable, except to us, each of us, inexpressibly. This man, that woman. Childhood is lost life, reclaimed every second, he said. 2 infants alone in a room, in dimmest light, twins, laughing. 30 years later, 1 in Chicago, 1 in Hong Kong. They are the issue of that moment. A moment, a thought, here and gone, each of us, on a street somewhere. And this is everything. I wondered what he meant by everything. It's what we call self. The true life, he said, the essential being, itself in the soft wallow of what it knows, and what it knows is that it will not live forever. The call came early. Searchers had found a knife in a deep ravine, not far from an expanse of land called the impact area, entry prohibited. A former bombing range littered with unexploded shells. They'd secured the perimeter around the object and were expanding the search. The ranger was careful not to refer to the knife as a weapon. Could be a hiker's or camper's, any number of uses. Elster was in his room sleeping. I made coffee, set a place for him, and left a note saying I'd gone into town. Blade seemed free of blood, the ranger had said. I drove toward town, then veered east for a time, and finally down toward the area in question. I left the paved road and followed a rutted track into a long, sandy wash. Soon, there were tall, seamed cliff walls crowding the car, and it wasn't long before I reached a vehicle dead end. I got out of the car and felt the heat, the brunt, the force of it. I didn't know how far I was from the search site and tried to call the ranger, but there was no signal. I moved around squat boulders dislodged from the heights by flash flooding or seismic events and came in the end to a tight passage and into an open space choked at ground level with brush and stony debris. And I half crawled to the top of a high rubble mound, and there was the whole scorched world. I looked out into blinding tides of light and sky and down toward the folded copper hills that I took to be the Badlands, a series of pristine ridges rising from the desert floor in patterned alignment. Could someone be dead in there? I could not imagine this. It was too vast. It was not real. The symmetry of furrows and juts, it crushed me. The heartbreaking beauty of it, the indifference of it. And the longer I stood and looked, the more certain I was that we would never have an answer. I walked back into the wash under the shallow line of sky and then stopped and put my hand to the cliff wall and felt the tiered rock, horizontal cracks or shifts that made me think of huge upheavals. I closed my eyes and listened. The silence was complete. I'd never felt a stillness such as this, never such enveloping nothing, but such nothing that was, that spun around me, or she did, Jessie, warm to the touch. I don't know how long I stood there, every muscle in my body listening. Could I forget my name in this silence? I started back, moving slowly and staying near the wall in intermittent shade. After a time, I began to think I should have reached the car by now. I was tired, hungry, water was gone. Just when I knew I was lost, I saw the trail widen slightly, and then there was the car, a dusty shit pile of metal and glass, and I opened the door and fell into the seat. I put the key in the keyhole and hit the AC button and the fan button and a couple of other buttons. Then I sat back a moment, took a number of deep, deliberate breaths. It was time to tell Elster we were going home. From the epilogue, briefly, September 4. Norman Bates, scary bland, is putting down the phone. The man was in place as always, his place, in body contact with the north wall. Standing was part of the art. The standing man participates. This was him. 6 straight days he'd been here. Last day of the installation. He would miss being in this room. Free at times to walk around the screen and to observe from the reverse side, to note the left-handedness of people and objects. But always, back to the wall in physical touch, or he might find himself doing what? He wasn't sure. Transmigrating, passing from this body into a quivering image on the screen. He was watching the tall, spooky house looming over the low motel, the turreted house where Mother sometimes sits by the bedroom window, and where Norman Bates assumes the vesture of cross-dressing hell. The man is afraid that the museum will close before the scene ends. The announcement will sound throughout the museum in all the languages of the major museum nations, and Anthony Perkins, as Norman Bates, will still be going up the stairs to the bedroom, where Mother is lying long dead. There is only the man and the museum guard now. The man imagines all motion stopping on the screen, the image beginning to shudder and fade. He imagines the guard removing a sidearm from his holster and shooting himself in the head. Then the screening ends. The museum closes down. He is alone in the dark room with the body of the guard. He is not responsible for these thoughts, but they're his thoughts, aren't they? He returns his attention to the screen, where everything is so intensely what it is. He watches what is happening and wants it to happen more slowly, yes, but he is also mind racing ahead to the moment when Norman Bates will carry Mother down the stairs in her white bedgown. The man separates himself from the wall and waits to be assimilated, pore by pore, to dissolve into the figure of Norman Bates, who will come into the house and walk up the stairs in subliminal time, 2 frames per second, and then turn toward the door of Mother's room. Sometimes he sits by her bed and says something, and then looks at her and waits for an answer. Sometimes he just looks at her. Sometimes a wind comes before the rain and sends birds sailing past the windows. spirit birds that ride the night, stranger than dreams. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
I always think when I read your work and when I hear your work that the challenge isn't to look beneath the surface, it's to see the surface. It's to see what's there. And I was thinking, just listening to you read, about two things. The second is about Psycho, but the first is about Barack Obama. An odd combination, I guess. A few weeks ago, or a few months ago now, our president went to Oslo to accept the Nobel Peace Prize. And his biggest applause line was, "That is why I have prohibited torture." There's a huge applause in the room, and I assume back here in this country. And I was watching it live at whatever strange hour of the night that was, and I thought, he doesn't have the power to prohibit torture. Torture is illegal by international treaty and by U.S. statute. And the only reason he could say, "I've prohibited torture," was because his predecessor had the pretense that he could order it. So this isn't really a witty observation. It's just a kind of an indication of how our surface world has changed dramatically, but we don't really see it. Torture officially was an anathema before, and now it has become a policy choice. And it seems to me that much of this book that you just read from so beautifully is about seeing, about what it takes to see. The prologue and the epilogue, and thank you, by the way, for giving me an excuse to watch Psycho again, which I did yesterday. The 108-minute version, not the 24-hour version, I should say. But the prologue and epilogue, in part, it seems to me, are about how differently we can see when time is slowed down. And the book itself is about time and seeing. And I wondered if you could begin. I mean, this book, unlike many others perhaps, has a very clear starting point. Henry James called these, you know, the donné, where the book came from, the seed of it. Maybe we could begin by talking about that just a bit.
Well, I did find myself in the sixth-floor gallery space at the Museum of Modern Art, where 24-hour Psycho was being screened. This is a video work by Douglas Gordon, who has done a great many video works. And I was rather astonished to find myself staying not 5 or 10 minutes, but several hours watching 2 frames per second in progress rather than the usual 24 frames. And so all suspense is drained from the movie, all terror, all fear. And I found myself thinking about how we see, what we miss seeing under normal circumstances, and what we can try to see when we're able to exercise total concentration, as in this kind of context. And after my third or fourth visit to this installation, I began to understand that I had to write about it. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure whether I would be writing fiction or an essay. But I thought in order to write a competent essay, one would nearly have to be a philosopher or a physicist or a cosmologist to understand the element of time, mm-hmm, that is being introduced here. Time in its most scrupulous and precise sort of detail. And I'll just say one more thing, that I once asked a philosopher, a man at Princeton, to talk to me about time. It's a curious subject, a fascinating subject, and I wanted to hear someone discuss it, someone capable of discussing time. And he said to me, time is too difficult.
Did he offer to talk about space or some other alternative?
No, that was the end of the conversation.
You know, in the book, there are a number of reflections, of course, about suspense, not least by Jesse. Well, let me make a quick observation before I go on to her, which is that insofar as the book is about seeing what's in front of us and the different things that allow us to or prevent us from seeing, I was struck in rereading the book today, I said this in the introduction, that not only is the book a thriller, which is evident to anyone who reads it, but it has a kind of deep structure, very intricately laid down, that poses both a question, a deep mystery, and to an extent, an answer to that mystery. Answer is perhaps too strong a word. And of course, readers will find that when they see the book. But what struck me is that almost no critics seem to have noticed. That is, that people who wrote about the book seized on much of the reflections about time, about power, about rendition, but seemed unable to grapple with the central mystery of the book, which really has to do with loss. And perhaps, is this, should one give a spoiler alert? I don't know. Maybe we should.
That's all right. You can.
Let's grapple with this. Precisely three quarters of the way through, Jesse, the daughter, disappears without a trace. Without a trace. And there is never a precise answer, but there is a pretty strong indication, a rather intricate one, of what has happened to her. And in fact, most readers who've written about the book seem not to have noticed that.
Yeah,
is that your impression?
It's a book in which elements fit together, in which an anonymous character may appear, and as the novel progresses, he'll reappear, or they will, in another environment, and this time with a name and a face and an identity. And this happens sort of in reverse as well, mm-hmm. to Jessica, who has a name, a face, and an identity, and then reappears toward the end of the book in the epilogue.
Reappears, in a sense, in the stage, the dark stage created by the staging of 24-hour Psycho.
Yes.
Which is really the fruition of a chain of causality that begins with her father seeing it.
Yes.
That begins with the filmmaker seeing it,
right.
and bringing her father to
right.
see it. Her father telling her she should see it. Her going to see it, where she meets this anonymous character who we hear about at the end of that reading, and who emerges as molecules, as it were, with Norman Bates.
Yeah. Well, you know, Psycho, the movie, the Hitchcock movie, is part of a curious lineage. There was a crime committed somewhere in the Midwest.
Wisconsin.
In Wisconsin, thank you. And and someone wrote a newspaper article. And then a novelist, in truth, I don't know who he was. I've forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Robert Bloch, yeah. It's my job.
a novelist was inspired by the newspaper article to write a novel, which then led to the writing of a screenplay, which then led to the Hitchcock film Psycho, 1960, which spawned two sequels, Psycho 2 and Psycho 3, with Anthony Perkins involved one way or another in both. And following this, there came another film, a shot-by-shot reproduction of the original Psycho, also called Psycho, by Gus Van Sant. And then Douglas Gordon did his video work, 24-Hour Psycho, which helped inspire the novel Point Omega. And so what we now need is the novel to lead to a crime, which leads to a new story.
Well, you know, what you're saying is that your novel had its birth in the mind of Ed Gein, or Ed Gein, I believe, is the original serial killer on whose two murders, actually, the original book was based. It's interesting that this movie, which I hadn't seen in a while, has within it a kind of critique of Hollywood, among other things. They didn't want Hitchcock to make it. He finally made it very cheaply, using his own production company that did his television shows, you know, in defiance of the studios. And in fact, there's a kind of reverse plot in the movie in which Marion Crane, which is her name, the name of Janet Leigh that we never remember, decides, having stolen $40,000 and having talked to Norman Bates, has a moral rejuvenation and decides to bring the money back, just as her lover decides he wants to marry her even though he has no money. So we have a happy ending about a third of the way through the movie, just before she's savagely murdered.
Yes, and the savage murder was totally unexpected and shocking to audiences, because Janet Leigh was the star of the film, and suddenly she is gone less than halfway through. And this was extraordinary.
Yeah, we were talking about this, that there's a documentary made on the making of, and they interviewed stars after the Hollywood or New York screening, and all of them were shocked. How could you kill Janet Leigh? This is completely unheard of and impossible. You know, the shower curtains that ring across 24-hour Psycho are only one of the echoes within the narrative, the main narrative of the book. We have that shower curtain that's pulled across by Jim Finley when he's looking for traces of the disappeared Jessica. He pulls the shower curtain and he realizes that he did it too loudly, that Elster may have heard him. There is essentially, you know, you want to think of Psycho as a framing narrative here in a sense, but in fact it isn't. It's embedded in the novel.
Yeah. And there are elements in common. And when I finished the novel, I realized, in fact, after publication, I realized that one of the elements in common was totally unintentional. I had no intention of doing this. There is a scene in the Hitchcock film, and in, of course, in 24-Hour Psycho, in which the detective, Arbogast, mm-hmm. played by...
Martin Balsam.
Goes down the flight of stairs backwards. And there are references in the central narrative to a woman who climbs downstairs backwards because of some physical ailment. And I had no intention of making this comparison. But there it was.
Oddly enough, that scene is one of those that was altered in the film from the original novel.
Yeah.
That is, he was killed in the novel in the bedroom, apparently.
I see.
Hitchcock decided to put it, you know, that very famous shot from above,
right,
in which he falls backward. And there's also, of course, a cut on his head, although he's stabbed him in the stomach.
Right.
This is all Psycho lore. Sorry about that. But one last question about that movie. Was this an important movie to you before you actually went into that room in MoMA?
You mean Psycho?
Yes.
No, it wasn't particularly. Mm. No, I saw it, I suppose, shortly after it appeared, and did not see it again. I'm sure I saw fragments of it in various contexts. And I tended to think of it as a comic movie, actually. Mm-hmm. It's the only way as Hitchcock did, yes. Mm-hmm. It was really the only way I could take it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Very effective. Hitchcock was a master manipulator. His main thought was to please the audience, to surprise the audience, to shock the audience.
To trick the audience.
And to trick the audience, exactly. Mm-hmm. And he did this, all of these things and more, in that one movie, perhaps more than in any other film. And it was a huge hit. It was an enormous, surprising success.
And he actually owned the rights to it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Hollywood and the studios that would not actually fund it did not have the last laugh. He made, in fact, he and his wife made a huge amount of money from the success of that movie.
Right.
Let's talk a bit about rendition. There's a striking passage in the novel, which you read, part of which you read here today, about rendition and an essay that Elster, who is the kind of defense intellectual who spent a couple of years in the Pentagon, frustrating years as they turned out, who wrote this essay partly, apparently, to displease the left and shock people. And it's described in a remarkable way as a piece partly about the sources of words, really, the etymology of words. And yet in it, he inserts a number of rather striking images, one of the torture of people in rooms and how that torture is based, at the end of the day, on the vengeance of nations. A very striking passage that you quote.
You've written quite a bit on this subject, and I wonder, do you ever think about the individuals involved in a much more personal, intimate context? That is, several people in a room, one of whom is being subjected to enormous pain by one or more of the others, about the personal interplay between them, the way they speak to each other, the way they think about each other. Does it at some point, can it at some point stop becoming about the gathering of information, of useful information from the subject, and can it become more personal somehow? I mean, based on all sorts of elements.
I think the answer to that is absolutely yes. And that, you know, it's interesting, when you write about this subject, essentially you're sitting amid an ocean of documents. And some of those documents come from the Department of Justice. Some come from the Department of Defense. Some come from the CIA. Some come from the Red Cross, interviews with those who were tortured. And it's odd because you're confronting, in a way, many different forms of bureaucratic language that seek to filter out exactly what you just described, so that you know, waterboarding is described as a controlled, acute episode, and you know, these documents, I often think of you when I read them because they're full of phrases like that you almost can't believe. They're juicy in this obscure bureaucratic way. And then every once in a while, you get some glimpse of what the room was really like. For example, there is one CIA person, interrogator, who got in trouble because he came up to a chained prisoner, and these guys are chained naked in a very cold rooms, their hands, their wrists chained to the ceiling, their feet chained to the floor, with hoods. This man came up to this chained person and smoked a cigar and blew all of the smoke in his face, continually trying to make him sick. And under CIA rules, that was illegal, though waterboarding wasn't. And this man's defense, I found in the document, was he wasn't trying to make the man sick. He was smoking the cigar to cover up the stench.
Mm.
And, you know, it's the only time you hear about the stench, that, in fact,
right,
you know, they were in diapers when the people wanted to be kind to them. And otherwise they weren't, and they were simply hosed down. So there is this personal world that kind of flickers behind the bureaucratic images. And you have to try to see through them, I think.
And it's all part of the creation of reality, which governments, most governments, are fairly efficient at doing. And speaking of creating reality, most of us are aware of the crash of the Polish jetliner not long ago, in which the president and many dignitaries and government officials were killed. And of course, they were going to a place near the Polish-Russian border. Katyn Forest. It's the Katyn Forest. And this was where, I think it was in March 1940, where Soviet massacred roughly 20,000 Polish officers, and then created the fiction that these officers were killed by the Germans. These were the early months of World War II, of course, and these bodies were thrown into pits in the Katyn Forest. And all these years later, the son of one of the army officers is the celebrated Polish filmmaker, Andrzej Wajda, who then makes a film called Katyn. And I believe it was among the foreign films nominated for an Academy Award.
Yes, it was.
It's a very powerful movie. And here is the artist creating the truth that has been obscured by the state, that the state has tried to make a fiction of. And it's an enormous sort of circle in which states live out their most massive fantasies and almost wait for the artist to find the truth.
They live them out and also are able to impose them on the minds of others. Yeah. One could have lived and died while believing that fiction. What fascinates me about the passage that you read on rendition, particularly the second quotation of Elster, where he talks about people in the future will be listening to tapes of people planning these things, torture. They will be talking about it in closed rooms. There will be hearings about it. What fascinated me about that is, on the one hand, we're at that point now. That is, we're already talking about it in that way, at the same time as we're not doing anything about it, really. And the second thing that fascinated me is that as we sit and think of the people in those rooms, which I've been talking about and you've been writing about, those people in the rooms were thinking about us looking back at them, which is to say they ensured that there would be Department of Justice documents saying that this stuff was legal. They ensured that responsibility went high enough and broadly enough that it would be impossible to try them. They ensured in all sorts of ways that this gaze backward would be a frustrated gaze, so that we have kind of two ghosts looking with their gazes crossing one another.
As our gazes cross, yours and mine.
As our gazes cross. I wonder if, you know, I have been in the last few years, and I have written about this and called it Frozen Scandal, because, you know, you're raised as a journalist, and you think, well, there's a sequence. There's revelation, then there's investigation by the government, by the courts, and then there's expiation. People are punished. In some way, the society returns to a status quo ante or a state of grace, if you want to speak in religious terms. And that seems to be something significantly different in the world we live with now. And I feel like that notion, Frozen Scandal, the idea that we simply live with things, like Obama saying, "I've prohibited torture," and taking that as a positive statement rather than what it really is, seems to me distinctive about this era, and it looms over that atmosphere, I think, looms over this book.
Do you have any idea when that started? The idea of living with scandal.
Well, I want to say 9/11, simply because I think the state of exception we're living in, which we're still living in, the state of emergency, whatever you'd like to call it, even though we've stopped seeing it, really began at that moment. I'm not sure that that's true. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, can it go back farther? Can it go back to earlier scandals and earlier disasters? I don't know.
You know, it does seem that we live, you know, as you've written about so much, in this age of images, of produced images. And when I think of 9/11, and you've written really in one way or another about 9/11 a lot, There's one novel, obviously, very associated with it, Falling Man. But you've written about it a lot, I think, in other ways, too, in an essay in Harper's, in your other books. When we think about 9/11, I think of it, first of all, as the creation of an image. You know, we think of it, obviously, as something that killed an awful lot of people, a horrible event. But it was the creation of this kind of iconic image that looms over our present world, an image that was supposed to say certain things. It was a way of speaking that says, you know, the U.S. can be defeated, these visions of power are arrogant and will lead towards some kind of fall, that the rest of the world, and particularly young Muslims, can succeed in a rebellion against the power of the United States. There is a sense in which it was a statement of a kind, do you think?
I'll say one thing, perhaps, that how different would the disaster have been if it hadn't been on film? How would we think of it? How would we know it?
It's almost impossible to conceive of it that way, without it being on film.
Yeah. And I hope we're not on film, and maybe we can end it here.
Well, I would say that insofar as we're trying to be as enigmatic and reverberating and resonant as the sentences that you read tonight, I think that is a fine place to end it. And I'd ask you to join me in thanking Don DeLillo.
Thank you. Thank you. Let's roll.
Let's roll.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.